The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Liz Elliott from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, June 2019, Volume 20, Number 6. This is the first of four installments of the June issue. On the cover this month, there's a bright white background, and there are three identical Oprahs. The first is wearing a yellow dress. It has a three-tiered skirt. It's bright yellow, long sleeves, and a V-neck. It's paired with orange shoes and purple earrings. It's very colorful. Oprah looks to be stepping forward. She's got her hands holding the hem of the dress and sort of flouncing it out, and her hair is blowing in the breeze. She's got a great big smile on her face. And using digital means, they've copied Oprah and put two Oprahs behind her. Same dress, same pose, but they've changed the color of the dress. So the yellow dress is now orange with pink shoes. And on the third Oprah, the dress is now coral with yellow shoes. And the rectangle in the top left of the cover has a gradient pattern on it. And it starts with the yellow of the yellow dress, moves to the orange of the orange dress, and ends in the coral color to coordinate with the dresses of the three Oprahs on the cover. And inside that gradient yellow to coral rectangle, there is, of course, the Oprah logo down there in white, almost a perfect circle with a big oval opening in the center. And the quote on this month's cover? Let every step you take move you forward. Now we'll go to the behind-the-scenes page at the beginning of Oprah Magazine. The title says, Here Comes the Sun. Sure, yellow can be mellow, but for this month's cover, Oprah went brilliant and bold, much to her BFF's delight. It's a happy hue. Love it, love it, love it, Gail said. Yellow also happens to be the perfect shade for kicking off summer fun, and Oprah caught the spirit, twirling her flowy frock and getting her salsa on to Elvis Crespo's Suavemente. Then, as Cardi B's Best Life played, she noted her trendsetter status. I've been talking about living your best life for a long time, Oprah said. Now everyone's singing about it. And there's several pictures on the page in the top left. There's a picture of Oprah in the yellow dress from the cover, and she's got on some orange shoes. And the quote says, I'm brighter than Big Bird. And a little note there says, for the cover, we threw a few other fresh-feeling colors, orange and coral, in the mix with the help of a little digital magic. And moving to the right, we see a picture of Oprah in the dressing room in a yellow dress, and sitting beside a picture of Gail in a yellow dress. They're pointing to each other, and the caption says, Who wore it better? Accidental twinning in the hair and makeup room. Across the bottom of the page, there's a picture of three summer outfits in the same hues that they used on the front cover, and it says, Vibrant Vibe. You can never have too many summer dresses. Whether you want something for work, weekends, or a wedding, this peppy lineup brings the heat. The first outfit features a sleeveless yellow dress. It is a bright, vibrant yellow, almost like a highlighter. Very, very bright, almost neon. And it has a self-belt, meaning that the belt is made from the same material of the dress. The dress skirt looks to be very long, approximately ankle length, and made of three sewn tiers of fabric. They're pairing it with a pair of gold hoops that are half gold for pierced ears, but the bottom of the hoop is made of a blue and white stone with a marbled effect. It's also paired with a pair of wedge espadrille sandals, kind of a low wedge, and the fabric on the top of the espadrille features the same yellow as the dress. It also has orange and white and turquoise, maybe a little blue to coordinate with the earrings. The dress is $129, and that can be found at Talbots.com. The earrings list for $330 at DinosaurDesigns.com, and the wedge espadrilles are Missoni and Castaner. They list for $210 and can be found at Missoni.com. The second outfit features a long-sleeved coral dress. Also has tiers on the skirt, looks to be maybe mid-calf length. The sleeves are sheer, and they have three ruffles sewn down the length of the sleeve that encircle the arm. The belt looks to be a woven rope, and it's woven of the same coral as the dress and maybe a darker burgundy, almost in a braided pattern with a little fringe at the end. It's paired with a hot pink pair of strappy high heels, ankle strap, and one single strap across the toe. And a pair of earrings that are for pierced ears. They feature a smaller turquoise stone at the top and a transparent disc of a purple material, almost like a shell, at the bottom. The dress lists for $326 at MisoLosAngeles.com. The earrings list for $4,775 at MarlaAaron.com. And the sandals are $100 and can be found at SamEdelman.com. The final outfit is an orange dress with a soft white polka dot. It features a smocked waistline and long poet sleeves and a V-neck with a little bit of shearing across the shoulders. It's paired with a pair of yellow beaded drop earrings. The top features three smaller beads, and then it drops to a large teardrop-shaped section with several yellow beads across the bottom. It's also accessorized with a pair of yellow wedge sandals. They're the same bright yellow as the earrings. They have an ankle strap and three straps across the toe, and the wedge is made of cork. The dress is Nicholas, $460 at netaporte.com. The earrings, $195, SusannaDai.com, that's Susanna with a Z, DAI.com. The wedges, $89, ninewest.com. And now we'll move to the Here We Go section, which is Oprah's monthly opening letter. It's a bright white background, and it's Oprah pictured in the same yellow dress from the cover, and she's still twirling that skirt. She's got a big smile on her face, and she looks so happy. And the quote that stands out from the text reads, "It can be scary to radically change how you understand the world, but it can lead you in thrilling directions." Have you ever had an experience that helped you see with new eyes? When something clicked for you that shifted your point of view? Such moments aren't always comfortable. It can be scary to radically change how you understand the world, but they can lead you in thrilling new directions. That's the takeaway from the stories you'll read starting on page 86. You'll meet women who not only altered their thinking, but acted on their new outlook to help make the world a better, safer, more just place. I hope they inspire you. Something else worth rethinking. Summer vacation spent visiting the same old landmarks and been there a dozen times hotspots. This month, we invite you to take the road less traveled as we serve up some of the most intriguing attractions, from an upside-down flower garden in Alaska to an encounter with sea creatures in Florida, in each and every state in this great nation. And what would this time of year be without a new look or two? Find yours in our Summer Style Guide, where you'll also discover fabulous swimwear no matter what your shape. Top it all off with a tropical pineapple-based recipe. Find those on page 118, and you'll have the makings of a very sunny season indeed. Enjoy! And after that preview of what we'll hear in all of our June episodes, let's go to the reading room and check out 10 titles to pick up now. The first is Lady Sitting by Lorraine Carey. In a radiant memoir, the author of 1991's Black Ice reflects on a year and a half she spent keeping company with her 101-year-old Nana, piecing together her family history from Barbados to Philadelphia. Number two is Dawson's Fall by Roxana Robinson. This avant-garde historical novel taps the real life of the author's great-grandfather, a newspaper editor known for his radical, at the time, anti-lynching views, to tell an all-too-resonant tale of fighting deep-seated bigotry. Number 3, Our Man by George Packer. Intrepid journalist, born vivant, UN ambassador, Richard Holbrook, 1941 through 2010, contained multitudes. This spirited, freewheeling biography by a National Book Award winner depicts an American as complex and contradictory as the country that begot him. Number 4, Finding My Voice by Valerie Jarrett. In a stirring volume illuminating the power of intelligence and grace, Jarrett narrates her journey from Iran, where she was born to American parents, to the West Wing, where she was one of President Obama's most trusted advisors. Number 5, Permission by Saskia Vogel. On the heels of her dad's accidental death, a struggling L.A. actress tries to debride her grief and fulfill her repressed desires by becoming a protege and occasional lover of the dominatrix next door in this dreamy, whip-smart first fiction. Possessed by Memory by Harold Bloom. The influential and provocative 88-year-old scholar and self-professed Shakespeare worshiper, for whom literary criticism is the holy grail, grapples with last things in an elegiac meditation on a life lived through books. Number 7, Strangers and Cousins by Lee Hager Cohen. In prose as effervescent as a bottle of bubbly, Cohen's sixth novel follows the screwball antics of a large upstate New York clan in the days before the eldest daughter's interracial lesbian wedding. Number 8, The Farm by Joanne Ramos. This gripping of-the-moment debut novel about a seemingly idyllic spa where the uber-wealthy spring for perfectly curated surrogate pregnancies is equal parts immigrant story, satire of privilege, and too-close-for-comfort feminist dystopia. Hybrida by Tina Chang. Chang's big-hearted, exacting lyric poems lay bare the solace and sorrows of mothering a mixed-race boy in post-Michael Brown America. I think my son senses what is happening on the street, his heart fiercely tethered to mine. I know the world will find him and tell him the history of his skin. Number 10, The Hot Young Widows Club by Nora McErney. The terrible, thanks for asking, podcaster, whose tragedy resume includes the deaths of her husband and father just 6 weeks apart, delivers a slim yet definitive guide to the unsoothable ache of elemental loss that is by turns poignant and hilarious. And now we'll leave the reading room and head to the feature articles for the June 2019 Oprah. And the front page is covered top to bottom with a picture of a clear blue sky. And right in the center of the picture is a parachute with an opening in the center. And the parachute has a rainbow pattern on it. But the opening in the center makes it shaped exactly like the Oprah O, where it's almost perfectly round on the outside and a big oval opening in the center. And the caption inside the big O says, June 2019. Meet a few remarkable women whose newfound perspective has them flying high with an invigorating sense of potential. Wherever your summer vacation may take you, our guide to America's 50 states of fun will help you make the most of it. And if you've ever felt pressure to blend in at work, you're not alone. But there's never been a better time to bring your whole self to the office. And we'll go ahead and dive into the beginning of these feature articles this month with a story entitled Transformer, how Angela King went from a hate monger to a peacemaker. Talking to the gentle-tempered, thoughtful Angela King, it's nearly impossible to imagine the 43-year-old activist as the brutal girl she once was, a neo-Nazi skinhead. But she's traveled ideological light years from her upbringing in South Florida, where her life gradually went from repressed to nightmarish. As a kid, I was sent to private Baptist school, which I think was less about religion and more about keeping me away from the bad elements, meaning black people. Before sixth grade, she transferred to a new school. There, King was mocked relentlessly for her poodle perm mullet, glasses, braces, and weight. "A bully ripped my shirt open in front of the entire class," King says. And all this intense rage just flew out of me. My kid brain decided if I'm on the offensive, nobody can ever humiliate me again. Soon enough, I was the school bully. Her parents had a messy divorce before King hit high school. "There suddenly there wasn't much structure," she says, "and I felt unwanted and unloved." She was accustomed to stealing her parents' booze and cigarettes, but eventually she moved on to using heavier stuff. LSD, cocaine, huffing Freon, you name it. She bounced between cliques until, at age 15, she found a home of sorts. "The group I befriended embraced swastikas and Confederate flags," she said. "I honestly didn't know what that stuff meant. I just knew I could be violent and angry around them, and they never questioned what was wrong with me. I thought, this must be where I fit." Before long, I was being indoctrinated. King dropped out of school at 16 and soon became fully entrenched in the extreme far right. I made my own propaganda where I wrote things like, "No white women should ever have abortions, but all other women should," King says. "I felt zero responsibility for anything. I blamed everything on someone else. My parents screwed me up, or somebody looked at me funny." But she felt a painful twinge in 1995 when 26-year-old white supremacist Timothy McVeigh detonated a truck bomb next to the Alfred P. Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168. Seeing the widely published photo of a firefighter holding a baby covered in ash and blood, "I had an intense emotional response," King says. She was horrified to realize that McVeigh shared some of her beliefs. They'd even attended the same far-right house party once. Guilt-ridden, she decided half-heartedly to disconnect from her gang. Within just a few weeks, though, they made it clear that wasn't wise, she says. "One night, at least 30 people carrying knives, crowbars, and bats surrounded my house, yelling insults. A few days after that, someone called and sadly said he'd watched my little brother playing outside by himself, so I stayed." In 1998, 8 years into her life as an extremist, King, then 23, was involved in an armed robbery of a Jewish-owned store. "The guy I was dating pistol-whipped the clerk and took the money, while the rest of us sat in the car as lookouts." After about 7 months on the lam, King was arrested and convicted. A couple of months after entering prison, she was smoking in the rec area when a black inmate struck up a conversation. She asked, "Hey, do you know how to play cribbage?" My answer was, "What is cribbage?" As the other women taught King to play, they talked. "We had no direct discussions about me being there for a hate crime," she says, "but I kept thinking, this is weird. This isn't what I've been told black people are like." I started to get close with her friends, too. I was being treated like a human by the women who I wouldn't have treated the same way had I known them before. In prison, King experienced another axis-tilting revelation. "I had my first relationship with a woman and came to terms with my sexuality," she says. "She hated me at first because she was black and knew why I was there. But over time, we started to speak transparently and realized we had more in common than we imagined. And we fell in love. She and her friends didn't let me slide about what I'd done, though. They held me accountable. One had an infant daughter and asked, 'If you met me and her before prison, would you have called us the N-word? Would you have tried to kill us?'" Their frank conversations forced me into intense introspection, says King. "As a young person, I became dehumanized. Those women rehumanized me." King served about 3 years of a 70-month sentence and was released in May of 2001. I was more afraid of leaving prison than going in, she says. I was fearful of repercussions from my gang, but also of myself. At times, my mind would automatically bring up a racial slur. I was terrified that maybe I was hardwired that way. She enrolled in community college, taking sociology, psychology, and religion courses. They inspired me to reflect on our country's troubled history. King had been out of prison a few months when her probation officer asked her to speak at a criminal justice class at a Miami university. My knees were literally knocking, she says. That led to more speaking gigs and outreach, work she did on her own for a decade before meeting other former extremists at a 2011 conference. Six of them formed Life After Hate, a nonprofit that conducts research on and helps individuals leave U.S. hate groups. King, now its program director, is mobilizing a nationwide network of volunteers and experts to assist those abandoning the far right, helping them with job training and having their racist tattoos covered or lasered off, which King herself, who'd gotten a swastika and Sig Heil ink, has almost finished doing. Though I've been disengaged for nearly two decades, I only forgave myself a few years ago, she says. The shame was so overwhelming. Finally, I thought, what am I beyond what I once was? Once, I would have described myself as a warrior, a proud white woman, willing to do anything necessary to save her people. I'll be apologizing for the rest of my life for that. But this work no longer feels like penance. I own my mistakes, but have compassion for myself. I've stepped into the human being I am today. I'm more than I ever could have given myself credit for. To the right of this article, there is a green column with the title Net Gain, the tech that turns values into action. And inside the sidebar, there are three small titles. One is Planning to Protest. Try the American Civil Liberties Union Mobile Justice App, which covers 17 U.S. states plus Washington, D.C. and counting. It lets you record audio and video, and then it sends it directly to your local ACLU office in the event you witness anything troubling. In case you're entangled in problems with the police, the app also contains detailed info about your legal rights. The second title reads, A Familiar Scenario. You're at the drugstore, but want to be sure the brand you're considering doesn't try out its mascara on rabbits. With the app Bicot, you choose campaigns that matter to you. Stopping sweatshop labor, banning animal testing, supporting the environment. Then scan a product's barcode to see whether it lines up with your principles. And the final title reads, Launched in 2017, ResistBot doesn't require you to download anything at all. Just text RESIST to 50409 to be enrolled. The service lets you contact your elected officials. When prompted, enter text that ResistBot will deliver via email, fax, or snail mail. It also lets you check the status of your voter registration, find upcoming town hall meetings, and see canvassing opportunities. Or write a heartfelt letter on current events, then text editor. ResistBot will send it to your local newspaper for possible publication and even copy edit it first. More than 1,700 such missives have been published. Our next feature article is entitled, Hiding in Plain Sight. Did you get the memo? It's now acceptable, even encouraged, to be your true self on the job. But as four women's stories show, combining the personal with the professional can be hard work. 7 years ago, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg famously leaned into the mic at a Harvard Business School event and urged her audience of future MBAs to bring your whole self to work. The idea being that genuine interactions on the job make us more invested in our colleagues and therefore the work we do. The message spread like an LOL cat video, and since then, financial institutions and tech firms alike have touted their embrace of authenticity, urging current and future employees to get and stay real on the job. The new Come One, Come All script for job listings, this one for a Walmart cybersecurity manager. We welcome all types of talent where your story is included and you bring your whole self to work. So what exactly constitutes authenticity on the job? In my case, it might look like this. I really like to raise my hand in a meeting because I have something to say, and coming from me, a Black Christian academic woman, it might be divergent from the other opinions being shared, explains Tina Opie, PhD, an associate professor in the management division at Babson College. But I do it anyway. It's what I want to do internally, and it's concordant with my external behavior. June Torres, PhD, a professor of work and organizational psychology at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, uses three metrics to evaluate whether employees feel authentic. You're able to engage in activities and behaviors that you find personally important and meaningful. You feel that your work fits well with your personal values, interests, and convictions. You don't have to hide how you really feel. And you don't need to put much effort into behaving the way others expect you to behave. Creating a workplace where employees ace Tarris's test can be profitable for everyone involved. We found that people who are authentic at work are considerably happier, more satisfied, and less stressed, he says. And happy workers get more done. Researchers have found that even a temporary boost in mood can increase productivity by around 12%. People who feel authentic in their workplaces are also more intrinsically motivated to do their jobs, which can help bosses, too. There's less need to micromanage. Sounds great, right? But there's just one problem. Being yourself at work isn't always easy. And suppressing part of one's identity can give rise to serious issues. According to Tarris's research, it's correlated with boredom and burnout. It's also been found to increase perceptions of colleague discrimination, which can lead to lower job satisfaction and thoughts of quitting. Opie puts it this way. Think of aspects of your identity as buckets. Say I have a woman bucket that's full to the brim. A huge part of my sense of self is all about being female, and I seek out opportunities to express myself in that way. Yet in my workplace, I receive constant feedback that women are not valued, so I feel the need to alter how I behave and how I present myself. I find myself carrying this heavy woman bucket and trying to hide it at the same time. Such circumstances can create a powerful sense of cognitive dissonance. In this case, having the psychological discomfort that comes with having one value while being rewarded for acting in opposition to it, that is compounded over time. The hiding can lead to shame, Opie says. You become upset with yourself because you think you're not proud or courageous enough to stand up to people who are devaluing a key part of your identity. The longer this goes on, and the more essential part of yourself you feel forced to deny, the more your mental health can suffer. Adamaris Mendoza, 44, started her career in the male-dominated finance industry. For a Latina Black woman, it's rare to get the job in the first place, so once you do, you feel like everyone is watching you. And according to Mendoza, they didn't like what they saw. Colleagues told her that aspects of her personality weren't a good fit for the field. I'm very expressive. I use my hands when I speak, and my voice is not exactly on the quiet side, she says. I'm pretty sure this is why I was often told in performance reviews that I came across as aggressive at work. So when Mendoza was around her coworkers, she tried to stifle these personality traits and become more corporate. She remembered the way her father, who had immigrated from the Dominican Republic and worked as an executive at Fortune 500 companies, would put on his work clothes every morning and, in her eyes, become another person. I started doing the same thing, she said. I covered up my real self in order to fit in. She splurged on designer clothes, shoes, and bags, not because she liked them, but because to her, They represented the costume of the modern businesswoman. It wasn't until she undressed at night that she felt like herself again. After a few months of this performance, Mendoza was finding it increasingly difficult to reconnect with her real self. She felt that she had put up a front, successful, satisfied, even around her friends. Hiding your personality at work takes a lot of mental and emotional energy, says Melody Wilding, a licensed social worker and career coach who specializes in the issues ambitious women tend to face. It leads to disengagement from everything. Mendoza began getting migraines. She stopped socializing and developed digestive problems. It got to the point where she was having so much trouble taking care of herself that she moved in with her parents. In our research, we talked to a lot of employees who feel like they're concealing a stigma, and in many of those cases, we've seen that there's real cost to hiding, says Mickey Heppel, PhD, a management professor, and the Martha and Henry Malcolm Lovett Chair of Psychology at Rice University. Some people who feel they are inauthentic versions of themselves have reported feeling pigeonholed, deceptive, immoral. They can become emotionally exhausted and more reactive to stressors. One study found that the more difficult it was for people to be real in their jobs, the more depressed they were. A separate study found depressed individuals tend to have work performance impairment. As one of the very few black students in her doctoral program, LaTanya Summers, PhD, was acutely aware of the negative stereotypes that might be lurking in the minds of her professors and peers, so she took care to be on her best behavior. "I didn't always speak up," she says. "There were times where I didn't share how I felt about certain things for fear of backlash or being perceived as an angry black woman." Summers, now an assistant professor of clinical mental health at Jacksonville University in Florida, worked hard to tread lightly and blend in. "I equated success with whiteness," she says. "White professors took me under their wing, and I'm so grateful for that, but I started to think and act like them," conforming to what she saw as the white standard, by dressing, talking, and expressing herself in a way that felt not black. And it worked. She shot up through the ranks of academia. In the process, she says, "I lost my racial identity." Summers found herself profoundly conflicted. Who was she anyway? This cognitive dissonance is a double whammy, says Opie. You'd like to be your authentic self, but if your audience has a positive reaction to whatever you've tried to change about your identity, that feels like a rejection of your authentic self. Then Summers encountered blatant racism, most notably from an older, white, female professor, and that sent her into a depressive spiral. Even when the effects of inauthenticity aren't dire, they still aren't conducive to doing great work or feeling good about yourself. Negative repercussions can include intrusive thoughts, distress, distractibility, and, in some cases, memory impairment. Even when you may appear to be maintaining relationships and interacting with ease, says Heppel, you may be missing out on genuine social support and the benefits of true friendship. Katie Kim, 29, discovered that compartmentalizing her personal and professional life proved much more difficult than she expected. When she came out to her family as a lesbian, it didn't go very well. So, after college, when she started as an analyst at the consulting firm Accenture, she decided to get back in the closet. "I thought, the people who love me the most in the entire world have a hard time accepting me. What can I expect from strangers?" she says. Besides, she didn't think her romantic life had any relevance to her job. She just wanted to put her head down and work hard. As Kim's career blossomed and her role evolved to include more face time with coworkers, she became increasingly uncomfortable with the fact that she hadn't told anyone on her team about her sexual orientation. "It was starting to get weird," she says. Conversations about weekend plans, for example, felt awkward. You can only talk about things in general terms, like, oh, I went out with my cousin, and then the conversation dies. Not being able to speak freely for fear of outing yourself might not seem intense in each moment, but over time it just made me feel sad and isolated. Bringing your half-self to work can also take a toll on the rest of you. At her previous job, Perry, who asked only that her first name be used, 26, worried so intensely about colleagues not understanding her religious convictions that she found herself flailing. Perry is a human resources specialist and Orthodox Jew who, 4 years ago, decided to follow strict observances, including abstaining from physical contact with members of the opposite sex. Though she might vaguely mention being religious, she refrained from saying anything about her religious practice. The absence of information put Perry in some uncomfortable situations. The people in her department were physically expressive, lots of handshakes and high fives. I eventually decided I would be okay with these gestures if the other person initiated them, she says, even if that person were male. Then she began to worry that not initiating professional handshakes might cause people to take her less seriously, so she started being the one to extend her hand first. Embraces were more complicated. Perry mediated a lot of intense conflicts, and it was customary for colleagues to hug it out afterwards. She tried to literally sidestep the issue, offering a sort of one-handed pat. But even this, of course, was physical contact, and ultimately, she felt like she was betraying her faith. These everyday interactions made Perry extremely anxious. Her ears would turn red. She'd itch all over. She'd become solemn and quiet. People would ask me what was going on, and I'd tell them I was fine, but I wasn't, she says. The irony, Opie points out, is that Perry's desire to protect her privacy may have had the unintended effect of piquing curiosity. Perhaps if there were more visible symbols of her religion, or if co-workers better understood her beliefs, they wouldn't have kept pushing her. Sometimes the best way to come clean about who you are is to change jobs and find a fit that feels right from the start. Last year, when Perry interviewed for a new position in a department of mostly women, she decided to tell her potential employers up front that her religious obligations prohibited her from working on Jewish high holidays, essentially outing herself as an observant Jew. She was nervous, she says, but I realized I didn't want to go through my career feeling like I couldn't share who I really am. To her delight, her new employer accepted these terms, and may Perry feel accepted as well. I'm not embarrassed by sharing my practices, she says. I see now that if I could have been open and honest with people at my old job, I could have saved myself a lot of pain. Katie Kim didn't want to change jobs. She wanted to change how coworkers saw and understood her. The trick was figuring out how to do that. While some people at work knew she was a lesbian, others who she interacted with daily still had no idea. It felt like something needed to happen, she says, but I wasn't sure what to do. She decided to open up to a senior product leader at her company, an openly gay man. At a happy hour for LGBT employees, she pulled him aside and confided that she was having a hard time. I asked him, how do you know it's okay to be out at work when it's not related at all to our ability to do our jobs? He said, Katie, it is related. You have to be authentic to yourself in order to be your best for your clients. He advised Kim to come out casually rather than making a big announcement. A few weeks later, she tried to play it cool as she dropped the word girlfriend into conversation with clients. After that, I felt so, so free, she says. LaTanya Summers had to be her own role model. Because of her mental health education and training, she was fortunately able to recognize what was happening to her. The crying, fatigue, self-doubt, repressed anger, and depressive symptoms were clear, and she saw treatment. After she finished her PhD program, she started a mentoring group at Jacksonville for female students of color. Says Summers, now 46, "It's important to me that other young women are able to find their voices and use them sooner than I did." Therapy helped Adamaris Mendoza, too, get through the worst period of her life and understanded that she needed to make a change. It also had a surprise bonus. When she eventually left finance, her therapist recommended Christian counseling courses, and Mendoza fell in love with the process. "I was so inspired by my own progress that I wanted to help other women," she explains. She trained to become a therapist, and then, 3 years ago, more than a decade after leaving finance, she became a life coach. "I could just show up as myself. I felt I could laugh or cry and be caring toward others. And those things attract new business. Clients often tell me they knew they had to work with me after watching one of my videos or meeting me in person," Mendoza says. "Now I tell them what it took me so long to learn. Being yourself might feel risky, but it's so worth it." To the side of the story, there's a little box that says, "Can you relate?" If you ever feel you can't be your true self in your relationships, that you're hiding some essential fact about the real you, we'd like to hear about your situation and how you deal with it. Go to omaginsider.com/share your story, and you may be featured in a future issue of O. Our next story is entitled, Truth Be Told, Mothers Helping Mothers of LGBTQ Kids. Wendy Von Zossen, a lifelong Mormon, grew up believing homosexuality was a sin. "I also believed that if I followed all the rules, none of my kids would choose that lifestyle," says Von Zossen, a mother of four. Her then 13-year-old son, Eric, tearfully came out 5 years ago. Her world crumbled. "Eric was my rule follower, so I knew he wasn't making a choice," she says. "Being gay was as natural to him as having 10 fingers and 10 toes. But anyone who's LGBTQ can't participate in certain temple ordinances that allow you to get into the highest kingdom of heaven. I thought Eric would be cut off from me for eternity." Von Zossen knew her son was scared and needed support, but reaching out to religious friends for counsel and comfort simply wasn't an option. After nearly a year of stumbling and struggling, she found Mama Dragons, a Facebook community since 2014, with 2,950 members and counting. Mama Dragons is a lifeline for mothers of LGBTQ kids struggling to comprehend their children's sexuality. Some parents arrive eager to advocate for their sons and daughters, but fear less than tolerant neighbors. Others show up believing that being gay goes against God's plan, but also that their LGBTQ kids need to be themselves. Regardless of a mother's initial acceptance or hesitation, the group offers a non-judgmental resource to anyone seeking answers to thorny questions. It also provides mentorship and information. Its site has a guide defining terms like polyamory and biphobia. And it hosts retreats and subgroups for Mama Dragons with trans kids whose first language is Spanish, also known as the Madre Dragones. Some participants have even set up hugging booths at local pride events. Says Vice President Lisa Dame, "I've had men in their 50s embrace me and confess, I haven't talked to my mom in years and it feels so good to hug you." Mama Dragons hatched as a safe haven for members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, whose leaders maintain that same-sex attraction isn't a sin, but acting on that desire is. Dame's daughter, Erin, came out in 2013, 3 years after ending her engagement to a man. While Dame felt ready to flaunt a rainbow flag, "I'd already mourned the loss of a temple marriage and grandkids and just wanted Erin to be happy," other family members balked. A close relative said, "It's okay if Erin is a lesbian, she just can't act on it." I looked her in the eye and said, "She won't survive that." Fear and confusion often snowball into a catastrophic crisis of faith. Mormon moms with gay kids face a horrible choice: follow doctrine that opposes same-sex relationships or be a loving mother, says Dame, no longer a practicing Mormon. I couldn't do both. But stepping away from my faith was devastating. I would have held on to that identity tooth and nail if I could have. Now I cling to Mama Dragons. Today the community includes moms of all stripes, even non-devout or liberal-leaning ones who feel alone or conflicted about their child's sexuality. Debbie Grew, who is not Mormon, doesn't identify as super religious, but has relatives who do, and lives in what she considers a conservative town. While Grew had never felt homophobic, her son Austin's coming out 2 years ago landed like a blow to the chest. I've never had a problem with gay people, but it's different when it's your kid, says Grew. I don't know why, but it is. Austin also didn't want me to tell anyone. So suddenly, I felt like I was in the closet with all these thoughts. What about HIV? What if he's killed in a hate crime? If he gets married, will family attend? When she discovered Mama Dragon soon after Austin's admission, she was eager to connect with like-minded parents. Says Grew, it was comforting to be exposed to people who had struggled like me but had come so far. Mama Dragons is there for parents at their most terrified. But it's also an enthusiastic audience for moms who want to boast about their children's achievements. Eric went to homecoming in drag, and I felt the most excited and supported talking about it with fellow Mama Dragons, says Von Sassen, now the group's president, who still attends church in an effort to be a voice for LGBTQ members. I've lost friends, but gain new ones whose beliefs align with mine. She's also established new rituals. I go with Eric, his siblings, and my husband to the San Francisco Pride Parade every year. Eric dresses as his drag persona, Creme Brulee, and I carry a sign that reads, "This Mormon Mom Loves Her Gay Son." Eric is confident as Creme, and I'm confident that there's no right way for a family to look. And our final article is entitled, "We Oughta Be in Pictures. Women Behind the Camera Saw a Need for Community in the Male-Dominated Entertainment Industry, and Now They're Shifting the Spotlight." With the recent success of lady-centric media like Big Little Lies, Girls Trip, Glow, and Wonder Woman, you might assume we're in a golden age of inclusivity. That is, until you look at the less photogenic fact. In 2018, only 3.3% of films from the Big Six Hollywood studios were directed by women. Of the top 250 films released, 73% had no female writers. And women account for just 27% of those behind the scenes in broadcast TV. The reports are a kick in the gut, says director Leah Meyerhoff, like confirmation that the system is just inhospitable to us. Even that sad fact couldn't dampen Meyerhoff's love of film. As a kid in San Francisco, sitting alone in dark theaters gave her a sense of belonging. I had a challenging childhood, she says, and watching movies about girls like me kind of saved my life. Cinema is an empathy-producing tool, and I wanted to tell new stories that would transform people's thinking, like film did for me. In 2013, while gearing up to direct her first feature film, Meyerhoff hosted a dinner party for a handful of women directors at her apartment in Brooklyn so I could pick their brains. The group compared notes on camera techniques and frustrations about their dude-heavy field. That night was so educational and empowering. At the end, someone said, "Let's do this again next month," says Meyerhoff. So we did. Meyerhoff named the group Film Fatales. Today, it's a nonprofit that supports a community of 1,000-plus filmmakers who've directed at least one feature-length movie, broadcast-length documentary, or scripted television episode, including Oscar, Emmy, and Peabody winners, in a dozen cities. Monthly meetings are held where attendees talk shop and share resources. Film Fatales also built a database that's searchable by filmmakers' demographic data and background. Production companies who want diverse talent with a specific perspective might reach out saying, "I'm looking for a Japanese-American director with horror experience. Can you recommend someone?" says Meyerhoff, and we send over a list. Meyerhoff is pleased by the progress she's observed. In 2018, NBC created a program called Female Forward, through which women directors shadow other pros, then direct at least one episode of their show on their own. Yes, Hollywood is like a giant ship that's slow to change course, but women filmmakers are getting themselves into important meetings, then helping other women do the same. When enough of us make our way out there, the system will change. Beside this article, there's a column entitled In Action, and it reads, More Group Turning a Lens on Inequality in Hollywood. The Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film, created and run by San Diego State University, releases detailed annual studies on gender representation in media for academics, journalists, and curious consumers. The organization's Celluloid Ceiling and Boxed In reports, now in their 21st year, offer info on women behind the scenes, while It's a Man's Celluloid World analyzes on-screen roles. As a part of the initiative, Reframe, launched in 2017 with help from Women in Film and the Sundance Institute, 60 ambassadors, including agents, directors, and producers, have committed to educating their industry peers on the dearth of XX chromosomes in media decision-making. Programs include addressing unconscious bias and mentoring up-and-coming female directors. Proclaiming, if she can see it, she can be it. The Gina Davis Institute, yes, that Gina Davis, has pioneered extensive research into gender depictions in media. Its work revealed that kids engage with media for up to 7 hours daily, during which they're exposed to alarming amounts of bias and stereotyping. A recent GDI report found that between 2007 and 2017, the top 100 family films featured twice as many male leads as female. If you'd like to celebrate female-driven films, Meyerhoff offers some all-star suggestions. Number 1. Buy opening weekend tickets to feature films directed by women, even if you can't attend. Strong opening weekends garner more press and build much-needed word-of-mouth momentum. Go to womenandhollywood.com for a list of projects currently on screens from female filmmakers and writers. Number 2. Support via streaming. The more often a show or film is watched, the more likely it is to be recommended to other viewers. Luckily, Netflix recently added a movies directed by women search filter. Number 3. Write online reviews of films directed by women. Visit the Amazon Prime Video, IMDb, and Rotten Tomatoes sites to add your 2 cents. About 78% of film reviews are written by men, and research indicates they rate programming aimed at women lower than female reviewers do. That's all the time we have this week for this month's feature articles, but we'll spend our last few minutes reading answers to the question of the month, which is, what was your most memorable summer vacation? Abasola Gallagher of Montclair, New Jersey says, last year I took a vacation alone to Aruba and loved it. I had no one else to be concerned about. I ate, slept, and did things all on my own time. Now I'm planning to go by myself every year. Kim Sundy of St. Joseph, Michigan says, while I was 8 months pregnant 18 years ago, I waddled around Martha's Vineyard eating ice cream and riding the carousel with my husband. It was a relaxing time as we waited for our son to arrive. Heather Cathrall of Pine Hill, New Jersey says, after college, I went to Alaska. I felt full of freedom and adventure. If I close my eyes, I can still hear the sound of icebergs breaking, smell the fresh air, and remember the magic of falling in love with a young man whose path crossed mine. It's a cherished memory. Lady Vanderlip of Talent Oregon says, when I traveled to my home country, Panama, and watched my mother's eyes light up when she met my children for the first time. Betty Janke of Hixton, Wisconsin says, spending 2 weeks in China with my mother and daughter. We visited my sister, who lived in Shanghai, saw the Great Wall and Tiananmen Square, tasted many fascinating foods, and took a 3-day cruise on the Yangtze River. Bert Suchsdorf of Troy, Michigan says, "We took our 3 children on a driving trip to South Dakota, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and Nevada, and hiked 5 national parks. The trip was a chance to reconnect as a family and sparked a love of adventure. The beauty of our national parks continues to inspire us and is one of the many reasons we're proud to be Americans, even in such contentious times." Lisa Liston of Lynchburg, Virginia says, "My family went on a whitewater trip to Labrador, Canada, traveling through remote wilderness. It was hard work, lining canoes through rough waters and portaging equipment around waterfalls, but the rewards were fantastic. We drank water from a river, saw a bear and her cub swim across, caught pike and trout, and rode fun rapids. It was unforgettable." Next month's question is, when was the last time a stranger brightened your day? And now we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Liz Elliott, sitting in for Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.